From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, death row defender David Dow and his new book, Things I've Learned from Dying.
The thing about being a death penalty lawyer in Texas is you just lose all the time. You know, you have way more clients get executed than you manage to save.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas saw its 500th execution in 2013, and we didn't stop there. By year's end, the total was 508 inmates put to death since 1982, when Texas resumed executions. 16 inmates were executed last year in Texas, up from 15 in 2012. Nationally, Texas led the nation in executions and accounted for 42% of all executions in 2013. Also in 2013, Texas saw the release of a 500-page report from the American Bar Association calling for reforms to the Texas capital punishment system in order to prevent more wrongful executions. University of Houston law professor David Dow has been part of over 100 death row cases, with the bulk of them ending in executions. At the UH Law Center, Dow runs a death penalty clinic in which law students assist in the representation of inmates facing execution. He is also the founder and director of the state's oldest innocence project, the Texas Innocence Network. Dow has written a new book, Things I've Learned from Dying.
I really thought that I knew everything about the entire emotional range of death. I've obviously, as you pointed out, had many, many, many clients be executed. And in many of those cases, I've known their family, moms, dads, brothers, sisters, sons, daughters, spouses. I've also known family members of murder victims. I had a very dear friend of mine who was murdered, and I have experience on, I suppose, both sides of the homicide equation, if it can be called that. So I think that I thought that I knew everything there was to know about death and about the sorts of emotions that are associated with it. And what I learned, and one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is that I really couldn't have been more wrong. I had two experiences that I write about in the book that taught me a whole bunch of things that I didn't already know, and I didn't know I didn't know them. One of those experiences was the death of my father-in-law, who I was very close to. He was really like a brother to me. That's how close we were. And he was diagnosed with melanoma when he was 58 years old, and he ultimately died from that melanoma when he was only 60 years old. And I learned things from watching him struggle against what proved to be a fatal disease. And then the final theme in the book, which in many ways is, I think, the most powerful one emotionally, is the theme about my dog dying. I've been a dog person pretty much my whole adult life, and my wife and I got a dog before we were married, as a matter of fact, about 6 months before we got married, and that dog died when she was 13 from acute liver failure. And I talked to some interviewer who had read a pre-publication version of the book, and she said to me that she didn't think that I had spent as many pages in the book talking about the dog, Winona, as I had spent talking about my father-in-law or my client. And I said, I haven't counted the pages, but I'll take your word for it on that. And then she said, but what he noticed was that even though I had spent fewer pages on the dog narrative than on the other two, she said she thought that I seemed to be much more emotionally affected on those pages than I was when I was telling the other stories. And I told her I think that's probably right, that that was perceptive on her part. That story had an emotional impact on me that I just don't think I would have been able to predict, even though, as I say, I've had dogs pretty much my whole life, and this dog is not the first dog that I've had to put to death. But it was a uniquely challenging experience for both my wife and for me and also for our son, who's now 13, but he was only 8 at the time, simply because her decline was so precipitous. She went from being healthy and robust one day to literally being at death's door the next. And so I wanted to write about the way these different events connected with one another, not just because they were happening in my life at overlapping times, but also because I noticed that the impact that they had on relationships was much more similar, I think, than I would have thought. So just for example, my wife was very, very close to her father. They had a very close and loving and wonderful relationship. And during the almost 2 years between the time that he was diagnosed with melanoma and the time he finally died from it, their relationship was altered and affected in ways that were very noticeable to me. And what was, I think, extraordinary to me is that at the same time, my client, who I represented for about 7 years, actually a little bit more, once he got an execution date, his relationship with his daughter, who had not had any contact with him for many years, was also affected in, I don't want to say the same way, but in similar ways. And it just made me start thinking about the way that imminent death alters relationships in ways that can be sad, I think, but can also be desirable in a lot of ways. You know, I think of human relationships as being organic. They have beginnings and middles and conclusions. And what usually happens is the relationship ends before there's really a conclusion. And the reason that it does is that we just lose contact with people, whether it's because they die suddenly or because they move halfway across the country or halfway across the world. And so I thought of relationships being very often like movies that you leave when there's still 10 or 15 minutes to go in the film. And what was different about these three cases that I was writing about, or these three lives and deaths that I was writing about, is that because in all three of those cases, the end of the death was known with some reasonable certainty, it was able to generate conclusions to all of these relationships that people had that I actually found to be uplifting and inspiring in certain ways. And that's really why I wrote the book. The subtitle of the book, I wish I'd thought of it. The publisher thought of the subtitle. The title of the book is Things I've Learned from Dying, but it was the publisher's idea to have a subtitle that said A Book About Life. And as soon as they said that, I said, God, I wish I had thought of that, because it's really exactly right. One of the reasons that I wanted to write the book is because in the course of observing these three different narrative strands that I weave together in this book, I gained understanding about how the awareness that death is imminent can really alter the way that we live our lives.
So, David, when I got the book and I heard about it, I thought this was going to be about death row, maybe about man's inhumanity to man and all these other things. I mean, you do talk about the death penalty process in text, but it's very much more a meditation book. It's not an essay about death row.
It's not. It's not a death penalty book really at all, I wouldn't say. Even the story that I tell about my client who was ultimately executed is really less a story about the law, although there's obviously some aspects of his case that I write about because they were very frustrating to me, but it's really more about his relationships too, his relationship with me, his relationship with other people inside the prison, his at least attempt to repair his relationship with his daughter. So I actually think of it more as relationship book than anything else. That's what all three of the stories that make up the book have in common, is that they're really all about relationships. And the obvious relationships are the relationships with my father-in-law and his wife and his children and me. And to some extent, I suppose there's an obviousness to the relationship between my client and his daughter, but I was, of course, also very interested in writing about the relationship between my wife and myself and our son, and how that was affected also by the experience of losing Winona. When Lincoln is our son, when Lincoln was born, Winona was 5 years old, and he became her project in a lot of ways. You know, he had really been my dog, and up until the time she died, she really was my dog. She came with me to the office every day. I was with that dog for close to 24 hours a day when I wasn't traveling. But what happened in that case, which was also the same as what was happening in the other cases, is that the imminence of death really had an effect on relationships beyond the person or the being that was actually experiencing death.
Speaking with David Dow, he is a professor of law at University of Houston. He's also well known as a defender for inmates on death row here in Texas. He's participated in over 100 cases. In the book, one interesting segment, you talk about what you do when you go to the pistol range, which I found was very interesting. And at the pistol range, they have a nickname for you called Grudge. Why do they call you Grudge?
Yeah, they called me Grudge because this actually started before I was married. And I had various exercises that I would go through in order to try to get rid of the anger, the frustration that I felt from losing all the time. The thing about being a death penalty lawyer in Texas is you just lose all the time. You know, you have way more clients get executed than you manage to save, and it can really get you down. And I've had, over the course of my life, different things that I've done to try to deal with that. And one of the things that I used to do before I was married is I would go out to a shooting range out kind of close to Hobby Airport, and I used to take photographs of people who I, you know, didn't like, and the first thing I would do is cover up their faces. I would cut out cartoons. I used to cut out the Calvin and Hobbes cartoon strip because I used to love it, and I would cut out panels from that cartoon strip, and I would put them over the faces of these people who I was mad at or frustrated with, because I wasn't sure whether it was legal, actually, to be, you know, shooting at a picture of him. So, you know, for example, I don't know if it's legal to take a picture of the president if you don't like the president and pin him to a target and shoot it. I know that people do that, but
you'll definitely get a call from the Secret Service if you do that.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't do the president. They don't need to worry about me with the president, but I know that there are people who do that. And I don't know if it's legal, but I didn't want to be violating the law. So I would take these pictures of people who I didn't like, and I'd cover them. I would put tape of Calvin and Hobbes cartoon figures over their faces. And then I would, you know, push the little button and send them out to, you know, 25 meters away and shoot at them from 25 meters. So the guy at the gun shop where I used to go to, he started calling me Grudge, because he said I was, you know, I had a grudge against these people that I couldn't get rid of. So yeah, so they used to call me Grudge, and I kept going out there for many years. I don't do it very much anymore. Every once in a blue moon, I do. But I had to get rid of
any famous names. Anyone I would know that you would target?
No, see, that's the whole reason I was putting cartoon figures over their faces, because I wouldn't want to reveal them. I'll put it this way: if I were to say the names, then I think you would absolutely, without question, recognize some of the names.
Okay. Just bring that up because it's an interesting contrast with what people expect for a person who is a, you know, death row defender. They would think it'd be a tofu eating liberal, but no, you're out there on a shooting range gunning down pictures of your nemesis.
I think you're right. I mean, I try to say a couple things in the book about those stereotypes. I mean, one is that, I mean, there are obviously people who satisfy and fulfill those stereotypes. The reason that we have stereotypes is because they're right a lot of the times. But the thing about stereotypes is that they're also wrong a lot of the times. I think sometimes people are surprised to know that when I started representing death row inmates, I was not against the death penalty. And in fact, for about the first 4, 5, 6 years that I represented death row inmates, I wasn't against the death penalty. Now, I obviously didn't think my own client should be executed, but if you asked me in the abstract whether I was against the death penalty, I would have told you no. You know, I'm not. So I'm not somebody who came to this line of work because I grew up with this intense opposition to the death penalty and this was the only way to satisfy it. I came to this work sort of circuitously, and for the first number of years that I did it, my opinions on the death penalty were pretty much the same opinions that most Americans and certainly most Texans have. So, and one of the things that I talk about in the book is how I think one of the mistakes that we make, and I tell this story, I think, not necessarily in the context of the death penalty narrative, but in the context of one of the other stories. But one of the mistakes that we make as human beings is we sometimes assume that we know what people think about something because of what they think about something else. So people might conclude that because I represent death row inmates, I'm somebody who, you know, would never own a gun, for example. But that would be wrong.
So let's talk about some of the new trends for the death penalty nationally and here in Texas. It's interesting. Some of the reporting I read about this, it said that there were only 39 executions in the United States in 2013, and that only would stick out of my mind. Only, but still, that is a reduction from the normal number of executions that we would see in the United States. Are you seeing a trend with changing attitudes about the death penalty?
Attitudes are changing so much in terms of popular opinion. There have been news stories lately about how popular support for the death penalty is at an all-time low. And I don't have any reason to challenge that conclusion. It might be at an all-time low, but an all-time low is still really high. It is still the case that something like close to 60% of Americans support the death penalty. So I don't think that you can explain the decrease in the number of death sentences and the decrease in the number of executions by a shift in public opinion, because I don't think public opinion has shifted all that much. I think that there are some other factors that are at work, and some of those other factors are that there are many, many, many fewer death sentences today than there were 15 or 20 years ago. So, for example, in Texas, it was not uncommon when I started doing death penalty work 20 years ago, it was not uncommon for there to be 30, 35, in some years, 40 new arrivals on death row, 40 new guys sent to death row every year. In the last 3 years in Texas, the number of new arrivals to death row has been in or near the single digits, you know, 8, 9, 10 people.
Right.
Why is that?
In 2013, 9 new death sentences were delivered in Texas. And that's where.
Yeah, 9 new death sentences.
That's where it was in 2012, and 8 in 2010, and in 2011.
Exactly. And that, you know, so that's exactly what I'm talking about. And that compares to 30, 35, 40 from the mid-1980s to the early 1990s. And so what's happened? Well, it's not that public opinion has changed that much. Now, has public opinion changed? Sure, it has. It's gone down from 65% of the death penalty to 60%. But that decline doesn't explain the precipitous drop in the number of new death sentences. Well, what's happened? Well, I think a variety of things have happened. One is that lawyers have gotten better, and lawyers have done much better jobs at trials than they did 20 years ago. Second thing that's happened is that people who are on juries have become aware that juries make mistakes, because we've had well more than 300 people from across the United States exonerated on the basis of DNA evidence. We've had people in Texas released from death row after their innocence was established. We've had people in Texas who were executed who are now widely believed to have been innocent. And that sort of consciousness enters the consideration of people on capital juries. And they don't want to make a mistake. If you send somebody to prison for the rest of his life, then if it turns out he's innocent, that's a mistake that can be corrected. But if you send him to the gurney and it turns out that he's innocent, it's a mistake that can't be corrected. So
Didn't the legislature pass a law around mid-2000 make it easier for jurors to send people to life in prison, life without parole?
In 2005, Texas adopted true life without parole. The reality is that even before that change, even when murderers were parole eligible, most of them were still going to die in prison because they didn't become eligible for parole until they'd already been there for 40 years. So if you went to prison, if you went to death row and you were 26, 27 years old, you'd become eligible for parole when you were 66 or 67. If you're living in what prisoners call the free world, then it's not uncommon to live to 66 or 67, but lifespans are understandably shorter in prison. There's less opportunities to live healthy lifestyles. And so even before Texas had true life without parole, the reality is that most people who were sentenced to life were never going to see the outside of a prison, but jurors didn't necessarily know that. And beginning in 2005, they could send people to prison for the rest of their lives. And if you're a juror who is worried about the possibility of a mistake, that's really attractive. So what happens is that you have trial lawyers doing a better job. You have jurors who are more reluctant to send somebody to death row than to the general prison population. And what that translates into is fewer death sentences. Okay, well, once you have fewer death sentences, two additional things happen. One is that people begin to realize that you can really keep society safe without executing people. The whole function of the criminal justice system is in part to punish bad guys, but also in part to lock bad guys up so that they can't hurt the rest of us who aren't bad guys. And what people begin to realize once you have a decline in the number of death sentences is that we can keep society just as safe without executing people as by executing them. So why execute people? And then the second thing that happens is that prosecutors who were never before accustomed to actually losing a case in the sense of having the jury say no if the prosecutors wanted to send somebody to death row, once prosecutors begin to lose a case now and then, it changes the entire economic calculation of whether to seek the death penalty in the first place, because seeking the death penalty is a very expensive proposition for counties. It costs many, many, many tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars more to pursue a death sentence than to agree prior to trial to accept a plea bargain and send somebody to prison for the rest of his life. And if you're a prosecutor really in a really rich county, you might say, you know what, I'm going to spend $1 million to send this person to death row, even though I could send a person to life in prison for $15,000 or $20,000. And you might make that decision because the county has a lot of money. But the thing is that if you spend all that money and then you don't get the death sentence, you've now gotten nothing more by spending $1 million than you would have gotten if you had just spent $20,000. And as soon as that happens in a poor county, they're very careful about seeking the death penalty again because they can't afford to waste $1 million. Even in comparatively wealthy counties, Harris County, Travis County, Dallas County, even in comparatively wealthy counties, as soon as you lose a couple of those cases, it just changes the economic calculation, particularly when you couple it with that fact that I was mentioning just a moment ago, that society is every bit as safe without the death penalty as it is with it. So I think you add all those factors together.
Yeah, Travis County has sent just three people to death row since 2008.
Look, district attorneys are elected officials, and they don't want to squander resources. And so once you show them that it's an unwise expenditure of resources to spend the money in this way, then even district attorneys who might not agree with death penalty opponents on the morality of capital punishment are going to recognize the fact that it's just an unwise use of financial resources.
We've seen a lot of exonerations in the last legislature. We've also seen the law passed towards getting rid of junk science in trials. It seems like there is a trend, an evolution going on in the mind of people about how we should think about the death penalty.
I think that there is a realization, recognition is maybe a better word, a recognition on the part of people who pay attention to the criminal justice system, even if it's just a tiny little bit of attention, that the system makes a lot of mistakes, way more mistakes than we would ever have thought before. There was a time where you could go down to the courthouse and talk to people on a criminal jury, and they would tell you that if the police arrest the guy and the prosecutors prosecute him, that probably means that the guy is guilty. And I think that that attitude, while still present, is much less common than it once was. And I think that that has to do with the fact that there has been such overwhelming attention paid to mistakes that have been made.
And prosecutorial misconduct, things like in the Morton case.
And prosecutorial misconduct. I think that when people hear a story like the Anthony Graves story, you know, this young kid who goes to death row for 12 years and then another almost 4 years in the county jail for a horrible multiple murder that he had absolutely nothing to do with. When people hear Anthony Graves talk, they are staggered to their core. I mean, he's telling them about something that happened that is unimaginable to most middle-class folks. Or when people hear about the Michael Morton story, some guy who spends 25 years in prison for murdering his wife when he had absolutely nothing to do with it, and when the evidence of who the bad guy really was sitting there all along just waiting to be tested but never was, people hear a story like that and it shatters their faith in the reliability of the system. And I think that's a good thing, not a bad thing. I think that we've had far too many years, far too many decades, where people have assumed that if the government is going forward with the prosecution, it means they must really have in their targets a guy who did something that was really horrible and worthy of punishment. And what people have been forced to reckon with, because the evidence of mistake is so overwhelming, is that that assumption, that faith that we've had, that the assumption is flawed and that the faith is very often unwarranted. And I think that that's healthy. I think that it's good for people who have contact with the criminal justice system to have some skepticism instead of having blind faith.
David Dow is a University of Houston law professor and the founder of the Texas Innocence Network. He has been involved in defending over 100 Texas death row cases. He has written extensively about capital punishment, including the book An Autobiography of an Execution. His latest book is a memoir called Things I've Learned from Dying, a book about life. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to Texas Matters with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can comment on our show page at tpr.org. That's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.